Hear the word of the Lord. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great, and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired I did not keep from them. I kept from my heart no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity, and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has been done before. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to both of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I have toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give it to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The word of the Lord.
In 1986-87, I was a senior in high school, and that was the year that the band U2 went from being a really good, great band to being kind of a stratospheric, worldwide phenomenon. They were on the cover of Time magazine. Honestly, I don't remember another band kind of becoming as big as they were ever since then. I went to college. I remember, you know, getting that Time magazine, reading through it, getting their cassettes and listening to them over and over. And I went to college, and college was just wrapped up with U2. I didn't know a single student who didn't have a poster, a cassette, a t-shirt, something about them. And that really was interesting to me. And as I began to listen to this song that we played at the beginning of the service, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. It was a fascinating thing because being a Christian from the country of West Tennessee in a fairly sophisticated school like Vanderbilt was difficult. I felt very lonely at times. And I had people on my hall from Connecticut and Philadelphia, and they would bring me in. At one point, I remember this, just we were talking about what we believe, and they were asking me. I remember that question very distinctly. Ricky, what do you believe? And it kind of hit me that they just wanted me to hear me say Jesus in my southern accent. You know, just they didn't really care. They just kind of wanted to snicker. And this particular student, he lived right across the hall from me, he had on his wall, it was too big to call it a poster, it was wallpaper. 10 feet high by 10 feet wide, 5-foot letters, "You Too." And I pointed to that poster and I said, "I believe the same thing they believe. I believe that Jesus carried the cross of my shame. So if you want to giggle at me, giggle at them." And it gave me this real comfort to know that I wasn't alone. That this, you know, these people that was everyone in the world were marveling at believed more or less what I believed. And the interesting thing is how that kind of changed as I became a sophomore. And so in my sophomore year, you know, I kind of buried myself in the Christian ghetto, which isn't that bad of a thing to do. It's better than, there are worse things you can do. And so, all my friends were Christians, and we did Christian things, and we went out. I remember going out on a Friday night, and we sat around the restaurant table playing this kind of, get-to-know-you game. It's kind of what we did. And the question was, name a song that kind of describes your life. What's your kind of theme song? And I said, "I still haven't found what I'm looking for." And I was rebuked. "No, you can't say that. You're a Christian." "Yeah? Well, but you have Jesus. You found what you're looking for." See, guys, I still think it gets better than this. I think it's okay that I feel that way. No. You can't be a Christian and say that. I think I can. I think I just did. And, I think it's interesting that this, I'm taking it as an assumption that you can be a Christian, a true believer in Jesus. You can trust Christ, you can love His Word, you can love His church, and still feel a nagging discontent. On a good way, we haven't found what we're looking for because we want to see the kingdom of God come. We want to see God's will done on the earth. And that day's not here yet. Oppression still exists. Sorrow and misery still exists, in case you haven't noticed. In a good way, we say we haven't found what we're looking for. And in a not-so-good way. In an unhealthy way. Even though we are believers, it is very possible to feel this nagging discontent, to have a wandering spirit that longs for more. And that restless, unsatisfied feeling can lead you down some very disappointing, dead-end roads. It can be harmful. Or it can lead you to a sweet, joyful, resting place. The writer of Ecclesiastes is taking us out into the fields, taking us out into the cemetery to talk to us about life. And he's going to say to us in this chapter, "I've been down that road. I know how you feel. I know God too, and I still felt like there was more. And I can tell you where not to find it, and I can tell you where to find it. Please listen to me. Avoid these pitfalls. Avoid the potholes that I've fallen into. And learn from me that lasting contentment will come from seeking the pleasure of someone else, not your own pleasure. Lasting contentment comes through seeking the pleasure of God." What does he say? He says, first of all, he says, "I have seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, all is empty, all is meaningless, and it's striving after the wind." I love that title, don't you? Striving after the wind, chasing the wind. You know why I love it? Because the wind is real. You know that, right? Like, you live in Oklahoma. You have been made aware that wind exists. I don't have to spend a lot of time trying to convince you that wind's real. And yet, you can't catch it. You can't hold it. You can feel it. You can smell it. You can be scared of it. You can be mad at it. Michael Boyd, who felt like my sermon, he went to the first service, and he felt like I needed some illustrations. So I was like, "Thanks, Michael." But he told me about playing golf down in Florida when he was on the mini tour, and he was playing with a guy named Cliff Kretzky. And Cliff had a putt, and he putted it, and the wind kept getting stronger and stronger and literally blew the ball by the hole. And Cliff was so mad that he threw down his putter and started punching the wind. Like, you're not hurting it. You can't catch it. It's real, but you can't catch it. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher, he's saying, these things that you want, that discontentment within you, it's real. These things that you're chasing after, they're real. But trying to find meaning in them, trying to find satisfaction in them, trying to find contentment in them, that's like chasing after the wind. You will never catch it. You'll never catch it. And he tells us the three things that he tried to, the three roads he went down, the three winds that he chased. He said the first was wisdom. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be business with, to be busy with. Now, there's different ways we use the word wisdom, you know, like being wise with your money or being wise with your relationships. In this particular case, he's talking more along the lines of kind of philosophy. Is there any way for me to understand through knowledge, by learning as much as I can I learn the purpose in life? Can I understand life? Can I understand why I'm here? Can I understand what it means to live a good and meaningful life? The same kind of questions that you studied in school and I studied in school and our kids will study in school. And he really just threw himself into it, man. Like, I want to know. And he found that wisdom was unsatisfying for two big reasons. As a matter of fact, he said this. He said, with the more knowledge comes more sorrow. The more I learn, the sadder I get. Why? He says, because what is made crooked can't be made straight. You know what we do from wisdom? We learn from our mistakes, which is helpful if we ever find ourselves in that place again, but won't fix the mistake. And so we just kind of have this ability to look back on what's crooked and go, oh, I see how we made that crooked. Well, that was dumb. I talked a few weeks ago about how we had this great plan in the 60s to desegregate schools, something that needed to be done. But the way we went about it, without qualification, the way we went about it was to fire every black teacher and shut down every black school and to take black students and force them to go to all white schools, which was destructive on many, many levels and once again unraveled a large section of black society. We didn't mean to. We know now. But what's crooked can't be made straight. We don't get the chance to go fix that. So with wisdom comes sorrow. Oh, we shouldn't have done that. Oh, darn. And our hearts break. And he says, not only is what's broken can't be fixed, but he says, what is lacking can't be counted. In other words, we can't sit down and count all the things that we don't know to count. You can be as wise as you want to. You can be as wise as possible and still not know what you don't know. And then you go and you make the mistake. And then you study the mistake and you go, oh, well, I sure wish we'd known that. Now I do. You know, it's kind of like asking a woman when the baby's due. And she says, what baby? Now I know. But you never get the chance to ask that question back, right? You never get to put it back in your mouth. So now, 50 years later, we're like, oh, the way we solved one problem was by creating huge problems. And you know what? 50 years from now, they're going to look back at us and go, hey, that was really dumb. You tried to solve the energy crisis by creating these great batteries. What did you want us to do with the batteries? Oh, now I know. We don't know what problems we're creating. And so with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more we understand about the complexities of life, the more we have to worry about. You know, you're... Parents, you ever sit and watch a baby sleep? Anybody, you ever watch a baby sleep? Or even better, just kind of watch a three-year-old play. And they're just playing those Legos or those blocks. And you just long for that kind of simplicity. You're like, man, he doesn't have anything in the world to worry about but pushing that car down the track. How nice it must be to be that at peace. The more we know, the more we have to worry about. And the more we learn about psychological studies, the more we see that we did wrong. Great. The more we learn, the more we seem to be saying that our grandparents did it just fine. But we tried to do something different and it didn't work. Bianca's read a headline to me this week. And said, now that we have the internet, now that we live in the information age, now that we live with more knowledge than any people have ever lived with in the history of the world, you know what we know for sure? You're doing everything wrong. And it had a link you could click on to see how you were doing everything wrong, from the way you cut cucumbers, to the way you buy your clothes, to the way you're raising your children. We're doing it all wrong. With much knowledge comes much sorrow. So what does he do? Ah, to heck with it. If I can't get there through wisdom, I'm going to quit trying. We're going to do pleasure. Makes sense, right? He says, I'm going to test my heart. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad pleasure. What use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. And how to lay hold on folly. Till I might see what was good for the children of man to do. Isn't that funny? It's kind of like this nerd writing it, right? It's like, I'm going to study exactly how to get myself drunk. That's kind of how it sounds. I'm going to study exactly how to make my heart happy with wine. I'm going to and it's not, of course, not just silliness. What is he saying? He's saying, I'm going to pursue hedonism. I'm going to pursue pleasure with my eyes open. As a serious course of study, not just doing it because I'm lazy, not just doing it because I don't have anything better to do. I'm going to pursue just sheer pleasure and alcohol and the joys of the flesh just to see if that really is the best way to live. That's not much different than what, you know, our society went through in the 60s. I mean, when Timothy Leary stood up and said, you know, tune in, turn on, and drop out, he really was saying, guys, college is not the way to go. LSD is the way to go. I've studied it. I've learned from this. This is the best life. It was a serious course of study. And so what does he learn? It was a serious course of study, seeking pleasure. He found that wine was a great way to escape the complexities of life until the next morning. And life's all still here. And we have people still learning that lesson, right? Russell Brand described being an addict, and he said, I don't have a heroin problem. I've got a life problem. Heroin's the answer. But the problem is, life is still here every day when I wake up. The way he's choosing to deal with it isn't helping. It's only making it worse. So if it's not the pleasures of hedonism, let's try another different pleasure. He used all of his wisdom and all of his wealth to build the perfect dream house, right? What do we want to do when we don't have, if we're unhappy with our life, what's the obvious answer? A new house with a pool. We all know that, right? So what does he do? He says, I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees. He built houses with pools. He had a dream house, had a mansion. That's going to solve our problems, right? We all know that. Everybody knows that a new house will make you feel better. Until, you know, your dog jumps on the new couch and you're madder than you would have ever been. Until the new house starts breaking and you're madder because you spent more money on this one. When my old air conditioners broke down, I just asked Jason to come work on them. They were old. I didn't care. Last summer, I spent $18,000 on new air conditioners. Now, when they don't work, I'm furious and I can't sleep at night. Because I spent money on them. They were supposed to fix everything and they didn't. One pastor told me of a friend of his who bought his dream house. Saved and saved and planned and built and went out every day. And he moved into it, and 6 months later, as things started breaking, and those little things that are annoying in small houses are really expensive in dream houses. And at one point, his fire alarms malfunctioned and started going off in the middle of the night. He had to go sleep with his parent at his parents' house, load his kids up, and go sleep at his parents' house. And he told his pastor, he said, "I started praying that God would just burn it down. It's just too much of a burden." So it's not ease. The more we build, the more we have to worry about. It's not pleasure. It's not wisdom. And then the writer kind of takes this little excursus, and he says, "So which was better? Which is better, wisdom or folly?" He says in verse 14, "The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to them all." You know what he's saying? He's saying it's better to be wise than it is to be a fool. Barely. Like a little. Because why? Well, the wise man has eyes in his head. He knows why he fell. But he still fell. Isn't that the story of Solomon's life? He wrecked his life with his inability to say no to himself, his inability to curb any of his desires, any of his passions. Kept adding to himself wives and concubines, and he wrecked his entire kingdom. But he was wise, so he knew why he did it. You know, knowing how to do something and doing it are different, aren't they? I know how to have more money. Stop spending. I know how to lose weight. Stop eating. But at 10 o'clock at night, I just got to have that cereal. Saying no to yourself isn't, I know what the problem is, I just can't do it. So if it's not wisdom and it's not pleasure, he turns to success. He turns to wealth. He adds to himself possessions. "I had great possessions, herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I had singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men." That's got to be it. If it's not wisdom, if it's not pleasure, it's got to be work and success. And what does he say? "It was all vanity, striving after the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun." Now I know for a fact, I'm going to tell you this and you're not going to believe me. That's all right, it's what I do. You won't find pleasure in your success. It's just going to lead you to have a better year next year. Again, Michael Boyd, who was very serious, like, "Your sermon needs more illustrations. Let me give you some." When he was on a professional golfer, he got to be friends with Lee Jansen, two-time U.S. Open champion. And he was playing one time with Lee and Paul Stankowski. And he asked Paul, he said, "You know, what qualifier are you going to go to?" And Paul said, "Oh, I'm not playing next week." He said, "What, you're not going to try to qualify for the U.S. Open?" And Stankowski looked at him and said, "Why would I want to play in the U.S. Open? Do you want to win it? Look at Lee. He's won it twice, and he's miserable." I know you don't believe me. I know you don't. That's all right. That lure of wealth. I was listening to a podcast, and a man says, he's talking about just arguing with his wife, and the arguments are always about money. He said, "If I'd known as a child how much money I was going to have at this age, I would have assumed that every day when I got home from work, I would go into my bedroom and roll around on my gold. And every fight's still about money. It's never enough." It's all vanity, seeking after the wind. All you end up with is this feeling of dissatisfaction, of occupational stress, of this sustained alienation from work. We end up with exhaustion and cynicism and feelings of inefficacy. It's not in work. It's not in wealth. It's not in wisdom. It's not in pleasure. Then where is it? He says, lasting pleasure comes from seeking to please another. comes from seeking to find your pleasure in seeing another person happy. Now, that's when you know you found love, when your greatest pleasure comes from seeing somebody else happy, and you want to live for that. And ultimately, he says that the way to have lasting pleasure is to find someone that you make happy who will last. Who will last. He says there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his work. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Pleasing God, that's as good as it gets. As good as this life gets is when you find your pleasure from pleasing God. Hear this, okay? I'm not saying, you know, accepting Jesus and become a Christian. I hope you've done that. But you can still be extremely dissatisfied with your life. Dissatisfied with everything about it. You can still wreck yourself on these roads. But to find your meaning, to find your meaning in making someone else happy. It's that simple. When I, you know, raising boys, everything's about competition. If you want your boys to get in the car, you don't threaten them. You just say race. Last one in the car loses, you know. And then, or first one in the car is the winner. And they rush to the car and you go, what did we win? Nothing. You got in the car. I won. I got you in the car. Who's the winner? I am. But, you know, at some point they get so competitive they start crying and, you have to look at them and say, you know how you can win every time? You will win every time if you will let your brother win and get joy out of seeing how happy you're making him. And they looked at me just like y'all did. Like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But it's true. You can control that. And when we enjoy what God has given us, not as... when we enjoy our job, he says, as good as it gets, is to enjoy the toil that God has given you. When we enjoy our job, not as this thing that's supposed to justify me, not as this thing that gives meaning to my life, but I enjoy it as something that God has given me to do that I love to do. When I enjoy it, I'm making him happy. And when I get pleasure from seeing him happy, that makes me happy. And you know what happens when I get happy? He enjoys seeing that I'm happy, and that makes him happy. And it creates this spiral. It's a lot like at Christmas when, you know, at some point along the lines, Christmas stops being a time of joy and starts being a list of chores. And one of those chores for my boys is to fill out wish lists, and there's nothing they really want. They pretty much have everything they want, and I have to tell them. I have to threaten them. I have to withhold food from them. You're not going to eat again in this house until you give your grandparent something, until you write down something that they can buy you. Because it makes them happy to see you open a gift and get happy about it. It makes them happy to see that they've made you happy. That's from the Lord. That's what he's like. Living to please God. He wants to see you smile over what he's given you. And so when we enjoy it, and maybe I should just make this the excursus, it's easy for you to say, the entire sermon, but you enjoying your job has no dependence on what it is. You know that? I know custodians who love their job. I am the son of a lunch lady who worked for less than minimum wage her entire life, who worked hard, long hours for teenage boys and girls who complained about her every day. And she loved it. She loved it. Loving your job has a lot more to do with you than it does your job. And when you love your job, when you love the things that God has given you and you enjoy them and he gets to see you smile over them, then he smiles. And if you know him well enough, if you've developed this relationship with him enough that you know when he's smiling, then you know where you belong and why you're here. And that's something that can't be taken away. Develop that kind of relationship with him. and enjoy things from Him as gifts from Him. That, he says, is as good as a man can have it. Please pray with me. Father, this sounds good. It actually sounds kind of easy. Just enjoy the life you've given us. But the problem is, Lord, we live our lives seemingly unaware that you even exist. We're not close enough to you. We're not aware enough of you to know when you're smiling and when you're not. Father, I pray that we would become those kind of people who please you. Who please you by enjoying what you give us as it comes from the hand of God. And I pray that we would find contentment in that. In your smile. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.